Chapter 9. Wednesday, the 24th of December. Course estimated east, 15 degrees south. Latitude estimated 46 degrees, 30 minutes south. Longitude 49 degrees, 45 minutes east. First part, fresh breezes at west-northwest. Latter parts, calm and fine. People employed pumping and thrumming spritsel to father ship. Water, 1.5 feet above orlop beams forward, 1 foot amidship and aft. Thursday, the 25th of December. Course estimated east 10 degrees south, latitude observed 46 degrees 37 minutes south. Longitude estimated 50 degrees 15 minutes east. Winds light and variable with haze and rain. Sea calm with several small blocks of ice. PM hauled up foresail, veered out stopwater to check ship's way, and passed fothering sail forward from abaft the sternpost, bousing it taut from the fashion pieces to the mizzen chains. The sail answered, and the pumps gained 5 feet in the day. Jack was copying his rough notes into the logbook, and when he came to this triumphant entry, he smiled. He was tempted to embellish it with an epithet or two, to add something about the feeble screech by way of a cheer when the gain of the first clear foot was reported, to describe the extraordinary change of spirit, the flood of new strength that sent the winches flying round, so that from having to encourage, threaten, beat, or even cajole the exhausted hands, their officers had to restrain their zeal for fear that the pump chains would break or choke yet again. To speak of the Christmas dinner, fresh pork and double plum duff, eaten with such merriment in relays. But he knew that even if he could find words to describe this change, a logbook was not the place for them. And he contented himself with drawing a small, pointing hand in the margin. His earlier notes, those that dealt with the first days after the boats went off, had been lost when he and the carpenters were trying to rig some kind of a rudder working out of the stern window. A following sea had set the whole cabin in a swim. They had recorded the Leopard's eastward course directly before the wind, for the most part, travelling on in what seemed a slow death agony, while all her people's efforts were divided between trying to keep her afloat and trying to get her to steer. The pumps never still, except when they broke down or choked with the infernal coal. The men perpetually heaving the winches round and sometimes even bailing too, when the water surged up through the scuttles and hatchways as though the ship were settling at last. Even now, with the leak so much reduced that the ship made no more than the pumps could throw out, the Leopard still couldn't be made to wear and stay. She was very much by the head, so that the water there didn't flow back to the well, and the almost invariably western winds with following seas kept her so. The first steering machine had been too heavy for its supports and had carried away. The remaining hawsers, towing vanes of one kind and another, had little effect when they were veered out, and none of the combinations of sails and drogues had moved ahead more than a few points. Now he and Mr. Gray were busy, or as busy as the poor old carpenter's failing strength would allow, with a steering oar, an object that harked back to the earliest days of sail, now taken up on an enormous scale. The question of steering had, of course, been of the first importance from the moment the Leopard had lost her rudder. But these last few days it was even more present to his mind than usual. At any moment now the Crozet Islands might heave in sight, and to reach them he must be able to manoeuvre the ship. Just when they might appear he couldn't tell. In the first place he had little confidence in the longitude laid down by their French discoverer, and in the second, his chronometers had been overturned in the drunken turmoil when the boats put off, so that he had only his hack watch for his position. However, neither he nor the Frenchman could be far out in the latitude, and he'd been keeping the Leopard as near to 46 degrees 45 minutes south as ever he could, though with these covered skies he could rarely make a noon observation. And for days now, in spite of the shortage of hands, the sharpest eyes in the ship had been at the masthead. The log ran on. Sunday, course, east 10 degrees north, latitude estimated 46 degrees 50 minutes south, longitude 50 degrees 30 minutes east, fresh breezes at west and west-norwest. Larboard pump sucked, rigged church for shortened prayers and thanksgiving, read articles of war, admonished William Place, James Hole, Thomas Paine and M. Lewis for drunkenness and sleeping. People employed about steering machine and pumps. Set the foresail and middle staysail. P.M., starboard pump chain broke for the eighth time. Hove up and rove again in under 1 hour. Jack had very nearly brought the book up to this day's date when the welcome drum began to beat, and he stamped out into the rain and down the hatchway to the wardroom. All the officers messed there now, and since both the captains and the wardroom cook had taken to the boats, and Killick's notion of cookery went little farther than toasted cheese, their food came straight from the galley unadorned. They still ate it in a certain style, however, and they still made a fairly creditable appearance. For with the captain presiding, this amounted to something like a cabin invitation, and they all wore at least a uniform coat. Although the remaining oldsters had come from the drowned midshipman's berth to fill the places left by Grant, Turnbull, Fisher and Benton, the long table looked rather sparse, particularly as there were no servants behind the chairs. But as Jack, Babington, Moore and Byron frequently observed, the fewer the better fare. Today's fare, by immemorial custom, should have been half a pint of dried peas and oatmeal, this being a banyan day. But the pumps still called for unusual exertion, and the steering oar was going to call for a great deal more. So all hands were allowed a piece of salt beef. As every officer took his full share at the winches, night and day, and as the temperature was only just above freezing, the wardroom ate up its beef with silent, barbarous avidity, relaxing only when the plates disappeared and the wine came in. A brief return to civility. The king's health, a very little conversation, and Jack said, "Well, gentlemen..." The steering oar was a most imposing affair. A spare foresail yard with a paddle at the seaward end. It was to pivot on the taffrail, strengthened for the purpose, and the inboard arm was to be moved from side to side by tackles to the crossjack yard and the mizzen. The rigging of such an engine called for a high degree of skill with ropes, blocks and the marlin spike, an intuitive grasp of marine dynamics. Stephen could be of no use. Indeed, he was invited to go away. And when he'd finished his spell at the pump, he stood at the rail, indulging himself with a view of the birds. They'd increased in number quite remarkably these last days. Skuas, whale birds, albatrosses and petrels of different kinds, sheathbills, terns, and he'd noticed that they appeared to be travelling to or from some fixed point to the north. The north, however, was at present swathed in rain, and he crossed to the starboard side where the light was better for looking down into the water with its splendid wealth of penguins. Here he'd seen a seal pursuing them, so that the little creatures shot from the surface almost like flying fish, but not so far nor so efficiently, alas. And here he had seen the seal herself pursued, hunted down and dismembered by a troop of killer whales, so that the sea turned red. Penguins. There they were, flying nimbly underwater, chasing long, thin fishes that in their turn were feeding amidst an infinity of fine, stout shrimps, as pink as if they'd been boiled. Duty called Stephen to the side of Mrs. Boswell and young Leopardina, and to his sick bay. Humanity called upon him to visit Mrs. Wogan. In vain. If her constitution can withstand a caesarean delivery in the midst of battle, he observed, 5 minutes' delay cannot much affect Mrs. Boswell. Besides, she's doing extremely well. No doubt she's asleep. 5 minutes. 10. And as the warmth of pumping was leaving him, as the wind was biting through his fourth waistcoat and comforter, he was rewarded by what appeared to be the seabed rising to the surface right by the ship, a vast dark area that grew clearer and clearer until it assumed the form of a whale. But a whale of unspeakable dimensions. Still it rose, unhurried. And as he stared, holding his breath, the sea rounded in a smooth boil, the surface parted, the creature's streaming back appeared, dark blue-grey just flecked with white, stretching from the fore to the mizzen chains. The head rose higher still, and expired a rushing jet of air that instantly condensed in a plume as tall as the foretop and floated over the leopard's bowsprit. And at the same moment Stephen himself breathed out. He believed he heard the hissing inspiration just before the head sank, and the enormous bulk slid over in an easy, leisurely motion. A dorsal fin appeared far back, a hint of the flukes themselves, and the sea closed softly over Leviathan. But his hurry of spirits was so great that he couldn't be sure. "Cobb! Cobb!" he cried, seeing the whaler and dragging him to the side. "What is that? Tell me what is that?" An acre or so of monstrous back could still be seen, moving slowly through the shrimps. "Oh, he's only a blue finner," said Cobb. "You don't want to take any notice of him." "But it was 100 feet long! It stretched from here to there." "I dare say," said Cobb, "but he's only a blue finner, a nasty, spiteful thing. You plant a harpoon in his side, and what does he do? He rushes on you like a thunderclap and beats the boat to splinters and then runs out 1,000 fathom of line. You don't want to take notice of him. Now, by your leave, sir, I must go aloft. There's Moses Harvey looking down quite old-fashioned for to be relieved." Chilled through and through, Stephen cast a lingering glance over the sea and went below. He looked at Mrs. Boswell's stitches with great satisfaction, and then made his way to the store that now served as a sick bay. Herapath was waiting for him, and together they inspected their only patient, the Turkish eunuch. This being Ramadan, the Turk refrained from food and drink throughout the daylit hours. And as he also refrained from pork by night, he was now in a very feeble state. They'd tried to delude him with artificial darkness, but some inner clock frustrated them. "The new moon alone will cure this case," said Stephen. And they talked about the general health of the ship. Most astonishingly good in spite of the long absence of fresh provisions and in spite of the incessant toil. This Stephen attributed to the great reduction in numbers, so that when the men slept, they slept with plenty of space about them and no vitiated air, to the bracing cold, and above all, to the sense of crisis that left no time for hypochondria. "And to this same sense of imminent disaster," said he, "we no doubt owe the singular harmony, the quasi-unanimity with which the work of the ship is carried out. No harsh words, no vehement rebukes are heard. The rattan canes, the knotted ends of rope, no longer encumber the lictor's hands. A cheerful compliance, even an anticipatory zeal, does away with the fretful exercise of authority. And upon this, perhaps more than upon any other factor but the captain's skill in navigation, we may rely for our eventual salvation. And no doubt it was providential that we got rid of the discordant element of those whom we might term the awkward sods. "We got rid of the Jonah, is all that matters," said the Turk, to their astonishment. "All's well, now no Jonah." Stephen walked over and looked down at the wasted, yellow, glabrous face. The Turk closed one knowing eye and said, "No Jonah now," closed the other, and spoke no more. "It's true, sir," said Harapath after a pause. "I've heard it all over the ship, my former messmates, all the lower deck. They were convinced Mr. Larkin was a Jonah. That was why he drank so much, they said, because he believed it himself. They were very pleased when he tried to get into the boat in the last rush, and," he added in a whisper, "I think some of them helped him over the side." Stephen nodded. "Likely enough." He would have offered some observations on the power of faith, had not the cry of "Land ho!" transfixed him as they formed. On deck they followed the pumper's staring eyes, and there, on the larboard beam, a snowy peak showed and vanished among the clouds some 10 or 15 miles to the north. Stephen, Harapath, the few remaining landsmen and convicts were jubilant. They would have cheered, capered, tossed their hats into the air, had it not been for the reserve, the anxious, questioning looks of the sailors. To these it was clear that everything depended on the steering oar. If it could bring the Leopard up to the wind so that she could stay and lie close-hauled on either tack, all was well. If it could even bring the west wind 1 point forward of the beam, the ship might make the land on the larboard tack alone, so long as the operation was carried out within the hour, before she'd been driven still farther to the east. But if the oar could not bring her up, or if it couldn't bring her even half up precious soon, she was condemned to travel on and on with nothing between her pierced bottom and the Antarctic sea but a piece of worn sailcloth that couldn't last much longer. Once again the ship broke into the most intense activity. Few could help in the long and complex rigging of the oar, but once the sails were so trimmed as to bring her head as far north of east as possible, they could all set to the pumps. They could all lighten the ship, so that she would answer her helm the quicker when she had a helm to answer to. "Huzzay! Heave round!" they cried, and again the water gushed out in a stiff, prodigious jet. Stephen stood between Moore and his remaining sergeant, both of them experienced theoretical seamen, and in gasps they kept him informed of the progress aft. It was maddeningly slow. They kept glancing at the mountain, clearer now that the clouds had dissolved in rain, and saying that the ship was not to leeward, no, not by a mile and more. It was plain from their talk of preventer guys, double rove and the like, that the captain was leaving nothing to chance. That was wisdom, no doubt. Yet a huge impatience welled up, a violent longing for the oar to be tried, perfectly rigged or not. An hour passed by. The rain beat on the pumpers' steaming backs. And at last some hands were called away to the poop. Those at the pump saw the head of the oar rise to its place just above the mizzenmast. They saw the tackles tighten, and after a pause in which the rain turned to sleet, they heard the cry, "Stand by starboard! Handsomely now, handsomely in half a fathom! Larboard ease away!" The Leopard's motion changed perceptibly. Still heaving the winches round like fury, the pumpers tended their faces to the wind, felt it come full abeam and then a little forward. They heard the familiar call of the men at the bowlines, "Heave one, heave two, heave belay." That meant the ship was sailing on a wind, a call they hadn't heard for weeks. 1 point free, but no farther. In spite of all the orders from the poop, all the movements of the enormous oar, the leopard would not lie closer. Jack couldn't set the driver, and all their recent labour to get the ship by the stern so that she would wear prevented her from coming up, or at least from coming up with any headway still on her. Still, said Moore, she'll do. A near-run thing, but she will do. And indeed Stephen, looking forward, saw that the leopard was heading not straight for the island, but a very little to the windward of it. Now began a long series of operations carried out with extraordinary speed. Yards were braced, jibs hauled down, set again and flatted in, staysails flashed out, hands sent to the larboard side of the forecastle and heads so that their weight might help. Every conceivable manoeuvre to get the ship a few yards to windward, to overcome her natural leeway, the effect of the waves that kept knocking her head off the wind, and that of the powerful current perpetually setting east. At first Moore explained these one by one, but presently he fell silent. And as Stephen watched the island, he saw it gradually move from the right of the bowsprit to a point where the bowsprit bisected the peak. And at last, when it was within a mile, well to the left. He had never seen leeway more clearly exemplified. All this time the leopard had been pointing due north, yet all the time she'd slipped a little sideways in a sea that was itself in motion, moving bodily away to the east, so that with the two the island itself appeared to travel west. Although the light was fading fast by now, a growing purple low in the southwest, the rocky shores were well in sight, with clouds of seabirds over them, and the minute forms of penguins, crowds of penguins, standing on the beaches or emerging from the sea. And what is more, there was a small sheltered bay, clear of surf, just under the lee of an outward-running spur. More orders from the poop. He's going to commit all his forces now, said Moore. Throw in his last reserves. Half a fathom handsomely. Half a fathom more, said Jack, and the island moved to the right. The little bay opened wider. Half a fathom. Christ! A long, rending crack, and the oar broke at the head. The loom and paddle went astern, held by a guy. The leopard's head swung from the wind. The island moved to the left in a long, slow, even motion, until it lay on the larboard quarter, dwindling astern, as inaccessible as the moon. In, mizzen, topsail and t'gallant, said Jack in the midst of the heavy silence. It was within 3 days of this that the first cases of scurvy appeared in the sick bay. All four of them were prime seamen, broad-shouldered, long-armed, powerfully built, responsible men, cheerful in an emergency, valuable members of the crew. Now they were glum, listless, apathetic. And only a sense of what was right kept them from complaining or open despondency. Stephen pointed out the physical symptoms, the spongy gums, the offensive breath, the extravasated blood, and, in 2 cases, the old reopening wounds. But he insisted even more upon the gloom as the most significant part of the disease. "I must confess, Mr. Herapath," he said, "that nothing grieves me more than this dependence of the mind upon the body's nutriment. It points to a base necessitarianism that I rebel against with all the vehemence my spirit can engender. And here, in the particular instance, I am at a loss. These men have had their sovereign lime juice. Perhaps we must inspect the cask. Most merchants are a sort of half-rogues, and quite capable of supplying a sophisticated juice. With submission, sir, said Herapath, it occurs to me that these men may not have had their juice. But it's mixed into their grog. With all the perverse wickedness of seamen with regard to their health, they cannot avoid taking it. We use the devil for a righteous end, execrable in theology, but sound in medicine. Yes, sir, but Fastadoodle, the tall man, was in my mess, and he often exchanged his grog for tobacco. It may be the same with the others. The dogs! The wicked dogs! I shall deal with them. A spoon, oh, a spoon there and half a pint of juice. I shall put an end to this. They'll drink their grog or be flogged. And yet, you know, he said, pausing, it will look strange in me, who have always set my face against their nasty rum, who circulated a petition throughout the fleet calling for the abolition of the monstrous custom by which grog missed during sickness is made up to the patient on his discharge, if I ask the captain to issue an order requiring each man to drink his tot. Still and all, in this case, a citrus drench will answer, I believe. The drench answered. The physical symptoms disappeared. But the gloom remained, and not only in the former patients, but throughout the ship. A perfect atmosphere for the breeding of disease, as Stephen pointed out. Apart from a score of the poor flippity-jibbity creatures who had been left behind by the boats, the men were attentive to their duty, but the fine drive was gone. The leak gained on them as the oakum of the first successful fathering worked through the leak, and the passing of a new sail was a slow, exhausting business that had little evident result. The Leopard drove eastward and a little south, and a small sail and a rising wind pumping day and night. At any time the weather, fairly kind for the 40s these last weeks, might break. The Leopard might have to run before an enormous storm of wind with the great seas building up, and the general view aboard was that she couldn't survive the half of it. Tell me, Mr. Herapath, said Stephen, in circumstances like these, were you supplied with a large quantity of opium? Should you take a pipe? Herapath shied away from the renewal of their intimacy. He couldn't tell, he said, probably not. There was perhaps something indecent in his use against mere apprehension. But then again, perhaps he might. Except when their work required his presence, he avoided Stephen whenever he could, either pumping beyond his time or shutting himself up in the cabin he'd inherited from the purser. There were many vacant cabins, both fore and aft. Now he said, "You will excuse me, sir, I've promised to put in a spell at the pumps." Stephen sighed. He'd hoped to engage Herapath on the subject of the Chinese poetry that seemed to be the young man's only consolation when he was deprived of his mistress's company. More than once in earlier days Herapath had spoken of his studies, of the language and its poets, and Stephen had listened greedily through half the night. But those days were past. And at present he would flee as he had fled now, leaving his papers on the sick bay table. Standing there alone, Stephen looked at the sheets covered with neat characters. It might be directions for making tea, he reflected. All the wisdom of a thousand years. But on one of the sheets he noticed a small interline translation. The direct word-for-word method that Herapath had explained. Before my bed, clear moonlight, frost on the floor. Raising head, I gaze at the moon. Bowing head, think of my own country. There was indeed a moon, 3 days from the full, riding through the sparse clouds beyond the scuttle. He sighed again. It was some time since he'd eaten or sat tête-à-tête with Jack. He felt a delicacy about seeming to force his confidence at this juncture. the more so as Jack was more remote, more closed in since the failure off that far island. Wholly taken up with the preservation of his ship, very often deep in the afterhold with the carpenter, trying to come at the leak. Yet Stephen missed those brief periods, and he was particularly pleased when, on his way back to his cabin, he met with a youngster foreshore, the bearer of an invitation when the doctor might have time to spare. There was nothing urgent. As he traversed the quarter-deck, he noticed a relative kindness in the air. It was distinctly above freezing, and a peculiarly brilliant star quite near the moon. "There you are, Stephen," said Jack. "How good of you to come so soon. Do you feel in the mind for music? Just half an hour. God knows what state my fiddle will be in, but I thought we might scrape, if only for a glass."
"I might," said Stephen. "But listen, will you, till I say you a poem? Before my bed, clear moonlight, frost on the floor. Raising head, I gaze at the moon. Bowing head, I think of my own country."
"That's a damn good poem," said Jack, "although it don't rhyme." And after a moment in which he too bent his head, he said, "I've just been gazing at her too with my sextant. A perfect luna, with old Saturn there as clear as any bell. I have my longitude to within a second. What do you say to the Mozart B minor?" They played. Not beautifully, but deep, ignoring their often discordant strings, and striking right into the heart of the music they knew best, the true notes acting as their milestones. On the poop above their heads, where the weary helmsman tended the new steering oar, and Babington stood at the comm, the men listened intently. It was the first sound of human life that they'd heard, apart from the brief Christmas merriment, for a time they could scarcely measure. And Bondon and Babington, who had known Jack for many years, exchanged a glance of significance. The last movement worked up to its splendid end, to the magnificent, inevitable final chord, and Jack laid by his violin. "I'm going to tell the officers presently," he said in a conversational tone, as though he'd been talking about navigation all this time, "but I thought you might like to know first. There's land laid down in about 49 degrees 44 minutes south and 69 degrees east. A Frenchman by the name of Tremarec discovered it. Desolation Island. Cook couldn't find it. But I think Tremarec was out by 10 degrees. I'm confident the place exists. The whaler off the Cape spoke of it, and he fixed the position with a luna. At all events, I'm confident enough to prefer the risk of not finding it to the risk of hauling north. I daren't carry a press of sail tonight for fear of floating ice. But in the morning, wind and weather permitting, and there's a big word, Stephen, I mean to put the ship's head south. I've not said anything before this, partly because I couldn't fix our position, and partly not to raise the people's hopes. They couldn't stand out against another disappointment like the Crozet's. But I thought you would like to know. You might choose to say a prayer or two. My old nurse always said there was nothing like Latin for prayers. Prayers or no, the morning broke fair and clear. And secrecy or no, there was already a certain eagerness abroad. The pumps turned somewhat faster. And if the spirit of the crew could be measured by the jet, it had risen by some 10 to 12%. The lookouts mounted to the masthead, not indeed at a run, but with none of the languor of the day before. Almost at once, one cried out for a sail far down on the southern horizon. and although this was dismissed as only another ice mountain, there were two monsters a mile to windward, and in the night the blessed moon had allowed them to avoid two more, the hail brought a new kind of liveliness. And when with infinite care the ship's head was brought due south and more sails set, this life increased surprisingly, overcoming the immense fatigue that weighed upon the ship's company like a pall of lead. No man or boy had had more than 4 hours' sleep on end between the spells of heavy pumping for as long as he could remember. "Good day to you, ma'am," said Stephen, opening Mrs. Wogan's door. "I believe you may take some air at last. The sky is clear, the sun shines bright with a surprising warmth, and although our poop is now the scene of strange activity, the gangway remains, the windward or weather gangway, ma'am, and we'd best profit by the morning while it lasts." "Lord, Dr. Matcherin, that would be paradise. I haven't seen the sky, nor you, this age. We've been a gaggle of women all together, knitting without a moment's pause and trying to keep warm. However, a baby's a great subject for conversation. Is it true we're going to the Antarctic Pole? Is the land at the Pole? I suppose there must be, or they wouldn't call it the Pole. Nor indeed would they want to go there. Pray try this mitten for the size. Dear me, your hand's grown horny to a degree. The perpetual pumping, I presume. Land! Of course, we can scarcely hope for shops, but I dare say there'll be the equivalent of Eskimos with furs for sale. How I yearn for fur. A deep, deep bed of fur, and a fur nightgown, too.
I cannot answer for the Eskimos, but I can guarantee the fur, said Stephen, yawning. These are the seas from which the sealskin comes, the darling of our modern age. I am credibly informed that the pole itself is ringed with seals 3 deep. And this morning alone I myself have seen enough to make a cargo for a ship of moderate size, or emplacement, as we say. Seals of 3 several kinds, besides 24 whales, and a plethora of birds, including, to my astonishment, a small duck, not unlike a teal, and what may well have been a shag. I'm infinitely obliged to you, ma'am, for your kind thought of mittens. All day they sailed, and all day the glass in Jack's cabin sank. It had foretold full gales in the channel and the bay, the wicked Mistral in the Mediterranean, a hurricane off Mauritius, but rarely had it dropped so fast. When he'd taken what few precautions the case would admit, he kept to the poop, watching the western sky out there on the windward beam, and all the while the sun shone bright, the deck gay with drying clothes, among them leopardinas, pink socks and caps. The leopard heeled pleasantly on the fine blue swell, and Stephen walked Mrs. Wogan on the gangway below, pointing out not only the kinds of seal that might make her bed, but those that would not, and 18 whales, together with so many birds that a less good-humoured woman might have rebelled. From time to time Jack looked at the masthead. He didn't wish to go up there himself, for fear of raising hopes that might be dashed, but with all his force he willed the man to hail the deck. He was in as high a state of tension and anxiety as he had ever experienced. And Mrs. Wogan's gurgling laugh sent a jet of anger through his mind. However, he paced on and on and on, his hands clasped behind his back, from the taffrail to the harnesses and back again, showing no emotion of any sort. And when the hail did come at last, he still paced on for a while before taking his best telescope to the fore-topgallant jacks. Yes, there it lay, high land, black rock beneath the snow, broad on the larboard bow. Even with the leopard's leeway and the current setting east at what he judged to be close on 2 miles in the hour, he could still fetch well to the windward of the land. Farther south and east, mountain peaks heaved up a great way off. and in the lie of the land he recognised the Frenchman's description of Desolation Island. He had no doubt of it. This was the landfall that he'd prayed for. With a sober, contained triumph, he climbed down, steadily packed on sail after sail until the Leopard's masts complained in spite of their extraordinary supports. To his surprise, water being but a shifting ballast at the best, she was astonishingly stiff. And once all her vast mass had gathered its momentum, the Leopard ploughed fast across the sea. He called young David Allen, the remaining boatswain's mate, and now the acting boatswain, and with him he told over what the ship possessed in the way of anchors and massive cordage. They'd done this before the sad day off the Crozets, and the sum was still much the same, amounting to the kedge alone, and just enough cablets and hawsers to veer out a reasonable scope. But since then, two carronades, intended not for the Leopard, but for the settlement of Port Jackson, and therefore carried in the hold, had been located and brought within reach of the main hatchway. These, made fast to the kedge, would give them an anchor not far from the weight of the small bower. Enough for her to ride at single anchor, given good holding ground and a moderate tide. And for the rest, sir? Asked Allen. For the rest, as soon as we're well in with the land, we shall reduce sail. You'll have the hawsers from the mastheads, splice them end to end, point them at the gunroom port, and then we shall proceed as circumstances may require. Allen looked a little blank, but the captain's placid assumption that such a task was well within his powers impressed him. And when he was told that he should have all the forecastle men and quartermasters in the ship, the pumps be damned, he went off cheerfully enough. Nearer and nearer, still with the land on the larboard bow. Before dinner, the most northerly shore was visible from the deck, right down to the white line where it met the sea. And after that meal had been gulped down, it was clear that this land was a bold cape running northwards from the mass. Nearer still. Jack paced up and down the poop with a quicker step. And although he had a crocodile's digestion, the lumps of ancient beef that he'd swallowed dwelt there under his rigid midriff, as firm and solid as when they'd left the galley cauldron. Growing cloud in the west. And in the pale sky southwards, the beginnings of an aurora. A shimmering curtain that wavered high up there, over a quarter of the sky, faint prismatic streams, perpetually falling, yet always in the same place. Three huge ice islands to windward, one of them 4 miles long and perhaps 200 feet in height, and several smaller masses scattered about the long, even swell, sometimes flashing as they rolled. When should he begin to reduce sail? To let the boatswain get to the precious hawsers. Could he ask the exhausted people to strike the topgallant masts down on deck against the expected blow, and then call upon them for unknown exertions when it came to securing the ship? How did the tides run in these uncharted waters? The threat grew stronger in the west. Lightning flickered on the far horizon. Far, but not so very far. The feeling of the day had changed. These and many more were decisions that only he could take. Collective wisdom might do better, but a ship couldn't be a parliament. There was no time for debate. The situation was changing fast, as it often did before an action, when a whole carefully worked-out plan might have to be discarded in a moment and new steps decided upon. This rested on him alone. And rarely had he felt more lonely, nor more fallible, as he saw the headland advancing towards him, and with it the moment of decision. The lack of sleep, the pain, the confusion of day and night for weeks on end had told upon him. His head was thick and stupid. Yet a mistake in the next hour might cost the ship her life. The swell was increasing and the wind. He knew very well that once it came on to blow as the wind could blow in the 40s, the clouds in the west would cover the sky with extraordinary speed, and this seemingly sweet day would turn into a howling darkness full of racing water. A visit to the cabin showed him the glass lower still, sickeningly low. And back on the poop he saw that he was by no means the only one to have noticed the mounting sea. An oddly disturbed sea, as if moved by some not very distant force. White water, too, and a strange green colour in the curl of the waves and in the water slipping by. He glanced northwest, and there the sun, though shining still, had a halo with sun dogs on either side. Ahead the aurora had gained in strength, streamers of an unearthly splendour. Below him, the pumps churned on and on. But both down there and here on the poop he caught an atmosphere of growing apprehension. Stiff though she was, the leopard was heeling now, so that her larboard cathead plunged deep on the leeward swell. And now the surf was rising higher on the icebergs and on the weather face of the headland on the bow. The howl in the rigging was louder and higher by far and growing fast, a dangerous, dangerous note. The broad expanse of water between the leopard and the cape showed far more white than green. And inshore, where there'd been smooth water not half an hour ago, there was the ugly appearance of a tide rip, a long, narrow stretch of pure white that raced eastwards from the headland and that must grow longer, broader and fiercer by far as the tide reached its full flow. The situation had changed indeed. But worse was coming, and coming very fast. A grey haze overspread the sky with the speed of a curtain being drawn, and it was followed by tearing cloud. The lightning increased on the starboard beam, much nearer now, and right ahead a white squall, the forerunner of the full, almighty gale, swept over the mile or two of the sea northward of the cape, veiling the land entirely. It was no longer a question of where and how he should negotiate the tide race, but of whether he should be able to approach the cape at all, or whether he should be obliged to put the ship before the ever-increasing wind and run before it. Speed was everything. In 5 or 10 minutes at this rate of increase there would be no alternative. He would either have to put before the wind or perish, or put before the wind and perish. The people couldn't pump forever. They were already very near their limit even with this encouragement. And in any case, the leopard would almost surely founder in the kind of seas that would build up before nightfall. The tide race was cutting up higher still, as nasty a race as ever he'd seen, yet the leopard must go through it, whether or not. Go through or run. And running could only mean the end somewhat delayed. "Whether or no, Tom Collins," said Jack to himself. And raising his voice to the full to be heard over the wind, "Jib and forestaysail, Mr. Byron, give her half a point." He'd made his decision. It had formed clear-cut in his mind, and now he was quite calm and lucid, somewhat detached. Speed was all, and the only question was whether the sails and masts could drive the waterlogged hull hard enough without giving way, whether the leopard could race the western gale across that mile of sea before it reached its full force and either flung her on her beam ends or forced her to run due east. It was a desperate choice. If any sail abaft the foremast gave, if the oar should yield, or any uppermast, then all was lost. But at least the choice was made, and he believed it was the right one. He only reproached himself for not having driven her faster sooner, for having lost minutes earlier in the day. With the greater speed, she gave a cumbrous great leap forward, like a cart horse spurred, and ploughed on faster still. The wind was now abaft the beam, and she buried her larboard bow so that green seas swept the forecastle. She was madly overpressed, but so far she could just bear it, and now she was racing through the tall waves, their white crests tearing head high across her waist. A gust on the rise laid her over so that her lee rail vanished in the foam. He gave her another point, he could afford it, and now she tore towards the terrible zone where the gale screamed round the headland with redoubled force and joined the tide rip. At this point, the adverse forces reached their highest pitch. The likelihood of being dismasted was very great. A quarter of a mile to go, the gale rising every second. "Main to gallant," he said, and she gave an appalling lee lurch as it was sheeted home. A moment's pause, like the suspension of life before a fall, and then she hit the tide rip. She staggered as though she'd struck ice. All round them the roar of breaking water and an intolerable wind, bursting seas on either hand, and a knockdown blow as the counter-eddy took a full aback. A confusion of water, green and white, spray covering her entirely. And as it settled, she was through, rocking in the smooth water under the lee of the high land. The transition was unbelievably abrupt. At one moment the Leopard was among bursting seas, furious winds howling upon her. The next, she was gliding along in silence beneath the shelter of an enormous cliff, her masts still swaying like inverted pendulums from the momentary counterblast that had knocked her captain into the scuppers. He picked himself up, glanced aloft. The upper masts had held, though the main-to-gallant sail had blown from its bolt ropes, and then leant far out over the rail to view the land. From the cape it trended westward, westward, towards a bay whose narrow mouth was almost closed with islands. "Bosun's party away. Alan, carry on and look alive. Mr. Byron, get the lead going, if you please," he said. "No ground with this line," came the cry, strangely loud. No other sound against it, apart from the water lipping along the side and the cry of seabirds. "Pass along the deep-sea line and let it be armed." "Pumps there! What the bloody hell are you thinking of?" cried Jack, but quite mildly. He would have stopped heaving himself at such a time. The long, stunned pause stretched on and on. The hands at the pumps heaving mechanically, staring about them as though amazed. The ship was still running fast of her own momentum through deep green water under the shadow of the monstrous cliff. A desolate land. Black rock topped with snow to the right hand. To the left, an island-studded sea. High overhead, the rack of a full western gale with thunder in the clouds. Down here, an unnatural calm as though the world were deaf. "Forecastle there," called Jack, breaking the silence. "How are those hawsers coming along?" "All off the foremast, sir, and stretched along." The solemn splash of the heavy deep-sea line. "Heave away, watch, watch, bear away, veer away," they cried. Then, 50 fathoms, sir." And after a short pause, "Grey sand and shell." In another mile, the Leopard had almost lost steerage way. The sky was now as low as the higher cliffs, and a thin drizzle floated down. Her sails hung limp, but from the mist of rain up there it was clear that a small breeze, a back breeze, drew in with the land. They set the remaining topgallants to take it, and so she glided on. "How are those hawsers now?" called Jack again. Fore and after," replied Alan from the break just under him, where he and Faster Doodle were long splicing like men possessed. The bottom shelved steadily, always with the same good shelly sand, and now, as she approached a passage through the islands that closed the mouth of the bay, the hand lead was going fast. "By the mark, 17. By the deep, 16. And a half, 16. By the deep, 18. A clear, deep water passage. And beyond the islands they could see right into the bay, a purse-like bay opening wide from its narrow mouth, a deep inlet sheltered on three sides. Jack stared intently at the nearer island. Its foot rose sheer, and from the motion of the spume and the current rounding over the black rock, it was plain that the tide was making still. "Man the braces," he said, limping forward. He didn't mean to run her on a shoal if care could prevent it, and this tide was moving her uncommon fast.
"Sir! Sir!" cried Babington, running after him. "There's a flagstaff at the bottom of the bay."
Jack took his eyes from the surface for a moment, saw that the bottom of the bay divided into two lobes, each with a strand at the foot of the cliff, and that on the height above one of them there stood an upright pole.
"Dear me," said, "so there is. Alan!"
"Sir?"
"How you come along?" "Hawsers, Nitzer, and pointed from the gunroom port."
Nearer and still nearer in, with seals staring up on every hand, some of monstrous size. One of the countless seabirds dropped filth on him. Oh, such good luck! And with his eye fixed on a small island near the shore, and his ear following the cry of the lead, he called, "All hands to bring the ship to an anchor!" A long pause while she ghosted still farther in, and then, "Down with the helm!" Her head came round. Hands flew to the halyards, braces, sheets, and clew lines, hove the mizzen t'gallant sailor back, and he said, "Let go!" The anchor and its carronade splashed down, and the hawser ran out as the Leopard went astern. "Stop up," he said.
"Stopper it is, sir,"
replied Alan. And indeed the Leopard stopped, brought up with a mild jerk that nevertheless staggered them as they stood. The hawser rose, and straightening took the full strain, and this was the crucial moment. Would the anchor hold? The anchor held. Yes. Yes, the anchor held. The hawser, though still taut with the tide thrusting on the ship, sank into a gentle curve, and the Leopard seaman breathed out a general sigh. Yet still, the turning tide, and God alone knew how fast it ran in these seas, could swing her, wrench the anchor from its hold, and fling her on the islands close at hand.
"Jolly boat away," said Jack. "Mr. Babington, be so good as to proceed to those rocks between us and the shore, carrying out a line bent to the hawser from the gunroom port. Haul the hawser to the rock and make all fast. You may have the spare iron horse if you choose, and a grapnel. You will take particular care to make all fast, Mr. Babington, and then perhaps," he said, grasping the wooden knight head, "we may sleep tight tonight."